Eddie and Martha Adcock are going to call in, and we're going to talk about all the great things they've been doing. Still making great, great, great music. Always looking for new things to perform as a team. And boy, they're so good at it. Eddie and Martha, are you there?
Yeah, we're here.
Oh, good.
Hi, Steve.
Good, good. I'm cranking up all my little volumes as high as I can. I plugged you into the mixer here, and sometimes we lose a little bit when we make all the connections, but I think if we just take our time, everything will be nice and clear. I'm just thrilled to death to have Eddie and Martha Adcock on the show today. It's just been a wonderful surprise that I could even arrange this, and I've been playing different cuts through the first hour of Eddie, and then Eddie with Country Gentleman, then I played a real funky cut with Eddie and Martha in the first half hour just to give all the listeners some idea of how broad-based your music is and what you're into, and I think they liked it.
Well, good. You could certainly take a long time to get across all our kinds of bluegrass that we've played over the years.
Well, and then the cut that I played from the both of you was kind of a funky rock tune from a different era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been through that, too. there's so many kinds of music that we're interested in, and they've sort of found our way into our hands over the years, and we did have a foray into sort of a country rock thing, just because we like all kinds of music, you know.
Well, and Eddie and Martha both, let me just tell you, this program here, although, you know, it's, I title it Unreal Bluegrass just kind of as a something different. It covers everything. I like good music. I like good playing. And so we have guests on here all the time that maybe always aren't right in the heart of bluegrass. Sometimes they are, but sometimes they're not. And sometimes they're all those things. So I'm this is perfect for me. This is a perfect opportunity to talk to the both of you about your music. And I'm just thrilled to death.
Well, you know, there's a wide umbrella that bluegrass has become. And what is it, Eddie, that your daddy used to say about music? There's two kinds?
Two kinds, good and bad.
And even that's debatable sometimes, isn't it?
You know, if you went into a record store and they just had two placards, good and bad.
Yeah.
They probably just put good on the whole thing so they could sell them.
Yeah. Well, Eddie, your recording career goes back to the point, and I've talked to several artists about this, when all of it was just country music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it was... you know, the back is in 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, bluegrass is known as hillbilly music. And this country and western, you know, the Roy Hiccups and people like that, they were known as country. You know, don't ask me where on earth the dividing line could be placed on that, but they had it separated into hillbilly and country, and I think only difference was is usually they were allowed electric instruments in country, and they weren't in bluegrass, so which was called hillbilly at that time.
Well, I mean, I don't know how you all feel about this. I think I know how you're going to respond to this. I have a hard time with... the people that want to pigeonhole music and I think exclude so many great musicians. I'm not saying that there's not some merit to having a broad, you know, discussion, let's say acoustic or bluegrass versus, you know, we can make an easy distinction. What we would all call bluegrass today as a starting point versus what we would all call country music today. We can make that clear distinction, but I have a problem with exclusionary type definitions when, as your dad said, it's good music and bad music.
Well, people are always feeling as if they want to get a handle on something. You know, we've got to have some way of identifying, I guess. And some people are a little more. I hate to use the word desperate. That's not quite right. But I think maybe the ones who are more engaged in producing music are a little less concerned about the labels of it because of where it springs from. It usually springs from the heart, particularly, and the mind is less engaged in naming it than it is to
quiet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Eddie, we touched a little bit about on your past, and I recognize when that you and Martha kind of came together, what, late 60s, early 70s. But, Eddie, if we can just kind of do a quick run-through for the listeners here of Eddie Adcock as you got into the what we all would recognize now as being a main stream of the bluegrass current back when you were really getting popular.
Except when I was doing it, that wasn't mainstream.
Well, you're right, but I'm saying now. I use the qualifier now it is, but back then it was not. Let's talk a little bit about what you were doing back in those days.
Well, we weren't doing anything but just playing it there again. We were playing bluegrass, supposedly our way, you know. It's all that we ever did. It's all I've ever did, as I did what I wanted to do it, I did it my way. And the country gentleman, when I joined the band, and leaned my direction on that too, and we became the country gentlemen rather than the Osborne Brother clones, because that's what the country gentlemen were. And when I joined them, they were just mocking the Osborne Brothers, and I did not want to agree to go to work with them because I'd been with Mac Wiseman and Bill Monroe and a whole lot of other people, and they hadn't been anywhere and did anything to speak of at that time. And I figured I had the clout, so I used it to take us a slightly different direction for bluegrass. But now we all know some of the people had called it, they used to say, some of the writers would say, it's pretty good if it's not bluegrass. Well, what wasn't bluegrass then has become traditional bluegrass today.
That's right. That's how it works more often than not. If it's good, as your dad said, if it's good music in that category, eventually it becomes recognized. Whereas now, if people were talking about, you know, play bluegrass like the country gentleman did, at the time you guys were pretty progressive.
Oh, we were extremely progressive, not only in the way we played, but in the way we looked and acted. We played to large college audiences all over the country, and bluegrass was still trying to grab a hold in an old, you know, bring a few people in an old schoolhouse or a church or an empty building or out on the lawn somewhere. But we had a direction, and we took it, and we didn't know if it was going to work or not, but it started working locally, so we figured if it works locally, it'll work nationally and internationally. So it did. So.
Yeah, I mean, there it is. The proof is in the pudding, as they say. Actually, the proof is in the eating of the pudding, if you track that whole saying down.
Yeah.
I agree.
Pudding doesn't prove anything. You got to eat it. But the saying is the proof is in the eating of the pudding. So I, no question about it. So the country gentlemen, yes, they're recognized now as standard bearers. At the time, you were out there sort of exploring different sounds. Let me ask you this, Eddie, before we get into the where you are, 60s, late 60s, early 70s type time frame. Your banjo style is very different, and I want you to talk a little bit about how you developed it. And when we all on this program talk about Scruggs versus Reno versus you fall in between all of these things, as far as that's my opinion anyway.
Oh, no. I have my friend Don Wayne Reno, who can play his daddy's stuff and play my stuff too. And he has a banjo camp down here. He doesn't live very far from here. If I knew the Don Reno style, I could go over and teach at his banjo camp. But I don't know. But he still gets me to come over and talk about him and me and his daddy to his students. So it's kind of like that.
I think Eddie's influences are more like inspirations, but there again, they came from different aspects of music, and it wasn't all necessarily country. He liked Les Paul, and of course he heard Merle Travis, and so he had these guitaristic influences, and to Eddie's way of musical approach, it's whatever comes into your head and comes out your fingers, and it doesn't really matter what instrument it's on. So he has ended up becoming known on banjo for different techniques, such as string bending and string hammering on with the middle finger, and a thumb style, a rhythmic sort of form of playing, and the single string that he developed himself as a consequence of starting out with a flat pick. So there are a lot of different things that have come into his playing to make it a lot different from, say, Earl Scruggs, who has largely been a role playing that is R-O-L-L.
Right.
R-O-L-E.
The three finger rolls.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I even roll much of my single string. I don't move my fingers back and forth. I found out I could get more speed out of moving, rolling all three of them. Now, if I'm doing it slow, I'll use my thumb and my next finger and my first finger. But if I'm not, that's the way to do. That's where you mimic the single string style with those two fingers. But if you'll play, say, Turkey in a Straw, in other words, to do it two finger style, well, you can get it a lot faster if you do it three finger style. Just roll it out. So you practice it that way, rolling the notes as if you were single string picking. So.
Do you,
that's why I do a lot of mine. That's why I can get such a high amount of speed on some of my real quick rolls.
Yeah. If anyone has ever seen Eddie and Martha play, and still to this day when you see Eddie, he's got a guitar on a stand and a banjo, and you move back and forth between both of them. And I don't notice that you really, you know, take your picks off and put them in your pocket. It seems to me you just kind of...
No, I don't. I use my finger picks for everything once I figure it out. I could use roll my single string because it used to get a little too fast for me. I just take a thumb thing, pick and a finger pick, and get that. So I incorporated the third thing. It was just sitting there, so I put it in and started rolling all the notes, and therefore I got my speed up to where I could do a pretty high amount of speed. Yeah. 160, 170 beats per minute, something like that, on single string.
It's fun to watch Eddie play, folks, if you haven't seen him play. And if you're cognizant of the different styles that are being incorporated with the single string and the scruggs, and then you recognize that Eddie is doing something wholly other, that's cut from whole cloth of his own, you know, what he hears and what he interprets and what he's inspired by. And when you see him doing this, you're thinking, that's kind of a neat thing, and it's getting the sounds that you want is what you're trying to do, is make it economical and clean to get the sound and the music that you want to play.
Yeah.
That's a very good picture of it. His musical life was, you would say, constrained, especially if you compared that to what the musical landscape is today. During the time of World War II, they had the old battery radios at home, and they couldn't afford new batteries. They weren't available during the war. You could listen to the Grand Ole Opry once a week, and that was pretty much it. And you had to heat the battery up in the stove in order to do that. And there were just not many musical opportunities to hear, so he grabbed onto whatever he could. But so much of it arose from within, as opposed to kids today have every single opportunity you can think of to bombard themselves with music all the time. And there's any number of ways to learn. To put together everybody's style and try to make your own thing or imitate anybody you want to. So Eddie's one of those people that comes from a state of real originality.
Well, I've
always admired that a whole lot.
I think you're right. Eddie, Herb Peterson was on the show last year, and I've always just enjoyed Herb's approach to music. And he used a term that I think everybody since has agreed with. I mentioned it. If they use this style, Herb says, "I was a needle lifter." Do you know what that means?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Just keep lifting the needle off the radio, off the record, and just putting it back and trying to rehear it again.
Yeah, I never had anybody to learn from. It was not a shortcoming. It ended up a blessing. As far as creating banjos for the rest of the world to play. In other words, I haven't made a lot of money, but I've made a path.
Oh, absolutely.
And that path has offered a lot of new banjo playing for people. I hear kids playing what I come up with all the time, and they don't even know where it comes from.
I know where it came from.
But
home.
They figure that was, that's just banjo use. That's always been
it. It came from homespun tapes.
Yeah, well, you know, I come up with slow playing before Sonny did.
Did you?
Oh, Lord, yeah. Oh, yeah. You didn't. Sonny wasn't even doing it in 1958, so I'm recorded in 58 doing it. Mm. So there you go.
Mm.
He didn't start until sometime in the 60s.
Mm.
And I would say that was when he started, maybe in 66, 65, 66, somewhere in there.
Eddie, this is great. I'm glad you had a chance to explain your style and your inspirations. And I want to get to the point where this young lady comes into your life, and that being Martha, and what happens?
Oh,
what
Lord,
happens
yeah.
musically? What happens musically then? And remember, she's listening. So.
Yeah, well, I met her in 1973 at the Old Time Pick and Parlor in Nashville, Tennessee. And she was working there as a pearl inlay and cutter, a pearl inlay person for Randy Wood, a really well-known luthist. And she walked behind me, and I was talking to Randy Wood. In fact, he was standing at the door taking up tickets, and we were playing there, I think, that night. And she walked behind me, and I never saw her, but I felt her. I felt the warmth, like somebody had just come in or something, you know.
Martha, what were you doing when you walked behind him?
She wasn't doing anything. She walked in there, and she just said,
"All right."
During the daytime, I worked there at the Old Time Pick and Parlor upstairs. Of course, downstairs there was a music store where they sold vintage instruments, and over on one side. Of these row of old warehouse type brick buildings down in Nashville. On the other side, right beside it, was a club, and so they had music at night. So I was down there day and night. And I hadn't been there very long, a couple of weeks maybe. Eddie had been on the road, I guess, with his band, and he came in that one night. And so when we met, you know, and people say, oh, this is crazy, this is not right, but we felt like we had known each other before, maybe in other lifetimes or something. And so when we found each other, that was just it. You know, we were just together from then on, and as of this April, that'll make 40 years ago.
Wow. Well, I want to talk more about this relationship in a minute, but Martha, how did you get into cutting inlay?
Well, I've always been an artist. Drawing was the first thing I did, even before music. And I'm interested in all forms of art. And combining art and music just seemed like a natural. And I had been traveling through Charlotte from South Carolina, going north to go to bluegrass festivals, which I discovered, you know, in the late 60s and early 70s. And I stopped in a little music store with pianos, and I was looking for some picks, and they said, well, the guy in the back might have some. And went back there, and lo and behold, there was a fellow named C.E. Ward, Clareman Ward, who was a very well-known luthier and a bluegrass player. And his shop was full of bluegrass people all the time. And he offered me a job doing that. And so I learned to cut pearl and do inlay work. And then, before too long, I was invited to come to Nashville to meet Randy and see we could work out coming to work there, and so I did, because Nashville was a really place to be back then, because the bluegrass was coming along once again in popularity, and country rock was happening, and it was all of a sudden a thing that kids could become immersed in, you know, that we were finding really, really popular. And it was sort of a left bank of Paris type scene over there on that side of the Cumberland. Just a wonderful place, so I was ready to jump and move to Nashville, and so that's how I got to Nashville.
Okay.
And
okay.
I got the inlay business.
Okay, so two old souls, not at the time old, but two old souls meet each other, and then there's a music relationship that develops. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, Eddie had a band that was a wonderful band called Second Generation that was exactly what I would have combined had I had the opportunity before he did. It took elements of bluegrass and country and folk and rock and jazz and blues and gospel and just everything, just whatever was good and felt right, and they put it all into a very cohesive whole. And so the day after I met Eddie, he took me to see this band, and I just said, holy moly, this is where it is. And not only is the guy great, but this music is great and his band's great. And so for that month, that spring and summer, I did the sound for the second generation. I learned to do that and really enjoyed that very much. And then that fall, suddenly, a spot came open to play guitar and sing with them. And so that's how we joined. Hmm. And I had been writing songs, and that's another reason I moved to Nashville. So it just all seemed to sort of fall into place.
So how does the decision then at that point become, let's do Eddie and Martha's show? How does that develop?
The second generation was a wonderful band, and then some things happened, and we had some personnel changes, and it just was working a little differently.
Well, the kids dropped a new kind of string music back when NEC, National Entertainment Council or whatever it was trying to get a foothold in the colleges. So we, you know, the musician would no longer be able to book the show without going through NEC first. So that took us, that we lost a lot of our audience because we didn't want to pay this $600 or whatever it was, but the NEC people. So we lost our college following and college places to play. Right in the height of it, too. I mean, we were really big at the time. You know, big stars were opening for us, who later on became big stars, you know, Jimmy Buffett and people like that.
Oh, yeah.
We were really big at that time, and then all of a sudden, we didn't have the schools to play anymore. Neither did he, but he had a big country hit, so we didn't have a big hit like that, so we just kind of fell out of favor and looked for something else.
Well, it was 1976 when we got married, and it's always a complicated picture, I guess. But then that's the year that we decided to go and do a duet. And subsequently, we went back to the band configuration, and we've been through all sorts of numbers ever since then.
Four to seven people.
Mm. Yep, two to seven, you might say.
2 to 7 years.
But we've been largely a duet for the past, 10, 15 years or so. But sometimes we perform as a trio with Tom Gray on bass. You're probably familiar with him.
Oh, I love Tom Gray.
Country Gentleman Days and Seldom Seen, and he's great to play with. But we sort of limit it to that, you know. That's kind of our thing these days.
Our band is a three-piece band, and our other band is a two-piece, Art and I.
Yeah. Yeah, two-piece with a number of instruments.
Yeah, well, you know, the whole thing in a nutshell is not how much, but what is the quality of what you have. And that's the way we're surviving nowadays.
Yeah, and it's
off of that quality of what we have.
I think a lot of people wouldn't care to perform in a duet format if they're used to a band. But we enjoy it because we get to get out there and give it 150% or 200%, if you will. And as Eddie is trying to say, there's no trees to hide behind, so there's the element of risk out there too. But it's something that we enjoy, and we seem to have our own fans and always an expanding audience. And when you think about it, that's sort of a tradition in this kind of music too. That there are a lot of duet acts going way, way back. So we're sort of part of that too.
Well, you are, and I think right now I can't think of another. I'm sure there are people who show up two at a time, but as far as a duet that has lasted so long and produced such a high quality, I think you're kind of out there on your own at this point. Although there's a tradition involved, but still at this point, Eddie and Martha Adcock, who we're talking to on the phone, by the way, if you just joined the program, you're sort of unique,
well,
I think.
From 46 out, the two-man band, you know, Bill and Charlie Monroe, Bill Nurl, poet, the Blue Sky Boys, and there's a lot of them, and it really changed the landscape for duos when the 1946 Bill Monroe band hit, and that's the date they count as the day that bluegrass was born in 1946. So it was born with a 4- and 5-piece band, so to speak. So with this duet, but prior to that, it was, you know, like I said, brothers and people playing just as a twosome. And even when they played with threesome, like there's an auto harp and a guitar and a singer in the most or a lot of the band. So, you know, it's the way it is went, I guess.
Well, and if you're just tuning in also, Eddie, before we went on the air, Eddie said he's got a bit of a cold, and I appreciate you fighting through that. I don't mean to have you talk, but it's really interesting, and I want you to explain it. And before we went on the air also, many people know this. And it was all over the internet, and everybody saw it. It was on the news, and I asked if it would be okay to talk about a operative procedure that Eddie had a few years ago. And Martha, you made the comment that there may be people that have a similar condition that don't recognize the opportunities available. And with that kind of vague description, I want to keep it vague, because I want you to explain what Eddie went through a few years ago. One of the most amazing procedures ever filmed, I think, just an incredible thing. Can we talk about that just a minute?
Sure. There's no problem with that. We're happy to, as a matter of fact. Eddie has always been one of those musicians who could play anything that came into his head. If it came into his head, it went straight out his hands with no problem. He didn't even have to process it all, it always seemed like. But maybe, I guess, 15 years ago now, or maybe just a little bit longer, he started thinking that he was having a little bit of trouble with his right hand. And then it developed that he was sort of having a tremor. And he went to a neurologist to confirm that he had something called essential tremor, which is that your hand doesn't tremor until you go use it. They also nickname it intense tremor. So for a banjo player, that's not a good thing to have. And the doctor tried a number of different medications, as many as a dozen, and nothing seemed to help it at all.
A period of 3 years prior to the operation, I was taking pills, various pills, to try to conquer this hand thing.
And some of them really sort of laid him low. And the doctor, being here in Nashville, says, well, there's a program over at Vanderbilt University Medical Center that may help you. They're doing a cutting-edge brain surgery called deep brain stimulation that may help you. And why don't we see if you're a candidate for that? There are a lot of risks, but it could really help you. And so Eddie said, well, sign me up. And turns out he was a very good candidate for it, and they performed the first of those surgeries in 2008, and it was just like magic. His abilities were restored to him. And so it's been such a miraculous thing that we have gone around the country at different organizations, invitations to speak to people about it, and we always try to mention it on our shows, and we get a lot of response from people who say, oh, I have something like that, what should I do? Because they don't even know.
Sure.
So it's sort of become a mission for us to help other people with that, because Eddie's been so remarkably helped with it. But he has ended up having two more surgeries, because the first one was what it is essentially, technically, is an implant, a thin stem implanted in his brain that has electrodes on it, and a wire comes out the top of his skull, runs under the skin, down to a pacemaker-type generator that's in his left side of his chest. Well, the wire was sort of exposed, you might say, even though it had that layer of the skin over it, and so he hit his head on the car door a few times, and the implant started acting rather erratically. Turns out he needed another surgery, and he had that in 2011, and they put it in a little different place and didn't quite get it to get his satisfaction, and so they were willing to go back in and do it again. And this was all performed while Eddie was on the operating table with a banjo in his hand.
Yeah.
So that he could tell the surgeons exactly where how far down to push that little rod of electrodes. Otherwise, they would just be guessing at it. So,
let me put this in there.
Yes.
Where it went down to the first time, I was supposed to tell them, and they stopped, okay? As soon as I could play, I told them, that's it. They stopped there, and I could play. The second operation, they said there would come up just four electrodes on the end of this wire that they put into the brain. There's four electrodes on it. And they decided instead of on top of an electrode, they would put a sweet spot right between two electrodes, and that way you get the benefit of both electrodes. Well, that's what they tried, and I said, but I can't play. They said, we can be able to adjust this out. You won't believe it, how good it's going to work. Well, it didn't work. The whole idea did not work. And so we went back to my way, and as soon as they did it, I was back playing again.
Well, Steve, Eddie's been a partner in the whole process, because this is a surgery that, up until Eddie's candidacy, it was something that was performed on Parkinson's patients who really wanted something as simple as to be able to drink out of a cup. And they had not been performing it on somebody whose fine motor skills were in question, and somebody like that they hoped to help. So Eddie was, I guess you could say, a guinea pig, and certainly a willing one. And it helped him immeasurably, and they've learned an awful lot from it, too.
So, well, sure.
It's been a good partnership. Those people over at Vanderbilt are just marvelous. They're just some of the most passionate and the smartest people that you can imagine over there. So we're just so proud to and honored to be associated with them.
Glad we're in the town with a good hospital.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I want, and people, when the show's over, I don't want them to leave until 5, but go to YouTube. It was on major network news. There were reports about it. There's a video. And the most amazing thing is that Eddie's sitting there with, I assume you took a during good time because it would be lightweight and easy to kind of move around with. And Eddie's sitting there, and they're operating on your, they're operating on your brain, and you're playing a banjo to tell them, kind of like fine tune it. And Eddie, what do you remember that? You were conscious, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had to be. It was something, the only thing I was worried about was if they lowered it, if the sweet spot was so small that you could pass it real easy with one of those electrodes, I was always worried about that. So I got it exactly perfect the first time. And their idea the second time didn't work. And the third time, I didn't get it as good as I got it the first time. It's like, but I still got good enough to play anything I want to play, just not quite as fast as I used to play it.
Is it more a hitch in like your giddy up? I mean, as far as getting started, once you get started, it seems to smooth out.
Well, what he does is Lee's unit turns off. He has an external controller that he can use to turn that hold over the implant in his chest, the battery pack, and turn himself on and off, literally. And he saves the power, the battery power, until when he really needs it, because we've always felt that if you get too used to it, so that current running through your brain, it may not do what you want to do when you need it. So most of the time he stays just normal and doesn't have very much problems. As well, as sometimes he brushes his teeth and he hits his nose, but it's a fairly normal life.
Well, sometimes I brush my nose while I'm trying to brush my teeth.
Well, maybe your nose needed brushing, Eddie. I don't know.
Maybe it did. But when he wants to play or write, he turns on. And so then when he's on, so there's no problem about it. He just comes right to it.
How long of a lag time between you turn it on and you feel the effect?
Instantly.
Really?
It takes about 2.5 seconds.
That's amazing.
1001, 1002, 1000. About that long.
That is just amazing. It's you know, I've seen it, I've heard you talk about it, I've read about it, but every time I think about that, you now have control of this battery powered device, and when you want to play and you want to do something without this tremor, you turn it on and you can do it. It's just incredible. And pacemaker is not a bad description of it.
Yeah, it is incredible. I mean, who would have ever dreamed that you could repair the fine motor skills of the human brain. And you know, banjo players especially, all musicians in general, have to move their fingers awful fast. And they also have to be coordinated, you know. So it's an amazing thing that they've done. And I was one of the luckiest people in the world to discover the fact that they were willing to try, and they believed it would work. And I didn't know what the heck to believe. I just believed in my doctor.
And he believed in playing. That's how bad he wanted to be able to continue to play, because he's always been all about music.
Yeah.
Now, even at the risk of death, strokes, all the awful things they described to him, we conferred about it, and that's what he wanted to do, and I was certainly willing to support him in all of that. So now he has the nickname the Bionic Banjo Player.
that's appropriate. I like that.
Well, I tell you what, that $3 million man ain't got much on me. My hospital bill.
Oh, jeez. Well, you're still pretty active on the roads. Matter of fact, Martha, I thought about catching you when you were driving through my part of the woods, and I thought I would love to talk to Eddie and Martha. And so your schedule, you're still keeping a regular schedule touring.
Oh, yes, we are.
We have to eat. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's what we do, and that's what we'll do as long as we can do it. So, and we're fortunate to have people that come out to see us, and new and different people all the time. You know, when you get to be our age, you have friends who are your age and even older. So it's good to see the young people coming in. And it's a very sort of fluid fan base. And dare I say that our bluegrass family is the dearest thing that we can imagine. We're just so grateful to have so many friends and fans all over the world. And that's one reason why we keep traveling, because we miss them.
Yeah.
See
you. Well, yeah, we like to go, you know, you're all over Europe, Japan, everywhere.
Wow.
We've been, you know, we made friends, and the only time we get to see them is when we go, you know, go see them. They can't come to us, you know, so we have to go to them.
Now, you're calling me from down in Tennessee today. Where are you going to be within the next week or so? Can you give fans that are listening into this program where you might
over
be?
Over next to Texarkana and Hope, Arkansas.
We head to
Memphis,
Tennessee on Valentine's Day. Some dear old friends over there are hosting us at a place where we've been playing a long, long time, and that we thought we weren't going to be able to have any more to play, but I think we're going to be just one more. You know, Memphis is known for blues, but there sure are a lot of good bluegrass fans there. And
if,
then we're headed down to Hope, Arkansas, which is in the southern part, so at least by the time we get down there, I hope we get some warmer temperatures.
Yeah, really. Well, and if people want to follow you, is there a website where they can track Eddie and Martha?
Well, it's been under construction in the past year or so, but I do try to post our shows and things on the various sites, so on the Bluegrass Bell and on Facebook and on the Bluegrass Sound, Bluegrass Today, and all the places where bluegrass people normally look for the bluegrass shows. I try to get those posted up there. And hopefully we'll get that website going again soon. There's just so much I have to put on it.
Well, and I would suggest to the listeners that make the effort to find Eddie and Martha Adcock and make sure you see them if they're coming to town. And it's just, you can tell, are wonderful people, great talents, and it's always been a fantastic show.
Well, thank you. We love what we do, and we'd love to see them out there, too.
If anybody would like, you know, you can Google Eddie Adcock. And there's thousands of sites and things about me on the website and on the web, and also me and Martha probably on there several times too.
Yes, and there's some things, a bunch of things posted on YouTube, so you just kind of can't get away from them.
No, it's everywhere. And again, when the show's over, I want people to go find this video of the surgery, because you can't, even though we discuss it in pretty frank terms, until you see it, you just can't imagine it actually happened that way.
It's hard to have escaped it because, as you say, it was on everywhere. It was on CNN. It was on Headline News. It was on, Good Morning America.
Mm-hmm.
Every TV show, newspaper in the world. So if they don't know his name, they usually remember, oh, yeah, gosh, are you that guy? I saw that. That was really wild.
Hey, Eddie, before I let you guys go, and we can barely scratch the surface of the career of both of you and Eddie, and so this is, I hate to cut this short, but I covered what we could in the time that I thought I wanted to take from you today, but there's a lot of banjo players that listen to this show, and I want to ask you what banjo are you playing on stage right now, if you can tell me.
Well, I'm playing the Ten Brooks or my Good Time.
Okay.
I mean, on my Golden Era.
Those are Deering banjos.
Yeah.
Deering.
He's played a number of banjos over the years, and most of them have been sort of unconventional sort of things, from the Epiphone to the Harry Lane to the Rich and Taylor. And then he went to Belling, and for the last 10 years at least, I guess, we've been associated with Deering banjos, and just can't say enough about those wonderful instruments and the wonderful people that run the company. And his main act, as you would say, is the Deering Golden Era.
Mm. Well, I would figure if you take one into the operating room that you ought to have a clear pass on being sponsored by them forever.
Yeah, they didn't want me to bring one of the high-dollar banjos, nor did I want to carry it, because it was uncomfortable enough on that operating table without having a 10,000-pound banjo laying on your chest.
Yeah.
So,
worked out
well. That's what they would weigh out to a 5-hour operation.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm a very pedestrian banjo player. I play for fun with friends, but they're like 12, 13 pounds, and that would be no good on an operating table.
No, it gets to be really heavy.
Well, he used his little Good Time, which is an open back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he saw that. Yeah.
Oh, I have one. They're great for what they are. It's amazing how good they sound with what they're made of, too.
Well, you know, the main reason I have is not so much the sound, although I played one of those in Europe, so I wouldn't have to take a heavy banjo. I played a resonated back Good Time,
mm-hmm.
and without a tone ring. That's what I took to Europe.
Yeah.
And I got it to sounding very good, and people thought it was a high-dollar banjo. Never, most of them never looked close, and then they wondered this, said, what in the world kind of banjo is that? And I'd say, it's a little cheap banjo that was made by, I shouldn't call it cheap.
No, it's not cheap.
It's
inexpensive. Inexpensive is what you wanted to say.
Well, Steve, as a banjo player, you probably realize that it's all in the setup.
The playability of the banjo, though, the neck is as good as any neck on any banjo anywhere.
Exactly.
The playability, if I'd have had that thing to learn on, Lord have mercy, I would have cut a lot of blood down.
Well,
my fingers bled because I couldn't get the right gauge strings or anything else.
I know, I hear you on that one. The other thing, too, Eddie, is it's in your right hand, bud.
Yeah.
That makes a big difference, all the rest of it. We can talk about the type of banjos and the playability and whatnot, but you have Eddie Adcock's right hand, so... that helps a lot when they say, what are you playing? It's Eddie Adcock playing a banjo, so it works out.
No matter what he's playing, he sounds like Eddie.
Exactly. That's my point. Well, this has been great. Gosh, we have to make sure we catch up again, and I'm so glad that we were able to work this out. And, man, I just wish you all the best, and I'm so excited to get a chance to talk to one of my heroes, and Martha. It's just been a blast. Thanks for working this out for us.
Well, we thank you for inviting us, Dave. You have a wonderful show, and you've had some great guests on, and we're just delighted to be part of it.
Well, thank you so much, Eddie and Martha Adcock. You all take care, and Eddie, get over your cold. We'll get some warm weather and get you cleaned up.
Well, yeah, I got to be over by the weekend coming up, so I hope I will be. I think I will be.
All right, man. Hey, listen, rest your voice, and then I'll look for you down the road somewhere.
All right.
Thank you both. All right, bye.
Bye.
Well, that was fun. Anytime you can talk to Eddie and Martha Adcock and... before we went on the air, the discussion was, do you want to talk about the surgery? And do we want to go into this again? Because it has been such a subject of news and reports. And yes, I want to. And there is a video. Go to YouTube and look for Eddie Adcock and Brain Surgeon. You will see Eddie on an operating table playing a Deering, speaking and telling them where to stick the probe. It's the most incredible thing. I still can't believe it every time I see it, so... I'm so happy we had a chance to speak with Eddie Adcock and Martha with all the history and the fun.